The 1911 is one of the most iconic firearms in history. Designed by John Browning, the 1911 was the standard-issue sidearm of the U.S. military from 1911 to 1985. While Colt produced the original, almost every major firearm company has produced its own version. It's wildly revered for its reliability, crisp trigger, and is still a favorite for all types of shooters. Whether you're looking to buy or build a 1911 and just about everything for guns, log on to MidwayUSA.com. At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com.
I'm April Vokey, and you are listening to Anchored, my chance to speak with some of the most influential people involved in the outdoors today. Join me as I sit down with my guests to learn more about their careers, opinions, history, relationships, and life both indoors and out. While I have you here, I'm excited to tell you that doors to our Anchored Outdoors membership are open. Right now, you can sign up to unlock the membership, its included courses, interactive events, perks, and a masterclass of your choice, all for only $60. Or you can unlock the entire membership and all 24 plus of our classes for only $200. You can pay annually or break payments down monthly. I'll wait for you here if you'd like to quickly hop on over to anchoredoutdoors.com to become a member. I'll be reaching out to you personally to say hello and welcome you to our community. Again, that's www.anchoredoutdoors.com. Derek Bird grew up fly fishing Rocky Mountain streams in British Columbia's Kootenai region. His passion for catching trout has taken him to some of North America's most remote destinations. He's the author of two books and is the founding editor of Fly Fusion magazine, where you can find his regular column, Streamlines. In this episode of Anchored, we cover his life as a writer in an ever-changing industry and take a closer look at why we make some interesting decisions in our younger years. This episode of Anchored is brought to you by South Dakota and their incredible hunting opportunities. In South Dakota, hunting is a shared legacy, something everyone can be a part of. That's why they're focused on making their fields a welcome place for everyone. See how at www.huntthegreatestsd.com, where you can hear stories from sportswomen and learn what makes South Dakota the world's pheasant capital. While you're there, check out public land maps, hunting blogs, and seasonal information for one unforgettable fall. Learn more at huntthegreatestsd.com. Rock and roll, here we go. Don't be scared. Don't be nervous.
I'm totally good to go. Now that you've said rock and roll, I'm like totally good to go.
Okay, good. So look, it's refreshing to be able to podcast someone, you know, who I know personally. And just to kind of give some context there, with now being able to record remotely and obviously be able to see my guests, but I've been interviewing people I don't really know personally, which I didn't realize how difficult that is to do. If you don't know someone's backstory, right, and their personality, it's really tricky. So it is, I just want to start by saying it is so refreshing to sit down again with someone I know personally. And I feel like we're getting caught up after, what did you say? It's been 4 years.
Well, yeah, I think we figured it was 4 or 5 years because so there's a few times that we tried to film together before, like out on different rivers. And and it was about, I think it was about 4 or 5 years ago that we last filmed together. And so, yeah, we were on that. Do you remember that like super crazy? Yeah, that super crazy. It was kind of some quad road that we took into some fishing hole and we were bouncing all over the place on that. Yeah.
Oh, and I introduced you to Too Short. And that is a memory that lives rent free in my mind that I wish that I, you know, those regrets. You're like, why did I ever rap that song for somebody? That's one of the
was that one of the ones that, yeah,
yes,
man, you know, yes. So
I will refrain from saying which song it was, but I do recall having,
right, yeah, no, I think that between you and my brother and maybe Victor the cameraman, I think that that you guys exposed me to a lot that trip, so
now, was that
you know what
one?
Though Go ahead.
Well, I thought I remember being pregnant on one of the ones, and you guys were like, no big deal, we're just going to hike this mountain. Like, well, I'm in my first trimester. I'm so tired. I can't do this. Come on, April.
That was a different one. You were such a trooper too. So here's the thing. Like, one of these times we're going to have to film together where everything's just kind of like normal, right? Because I think every time we film together, it's like we're talking a little bit ago about how the first time that we tried to film together, you had like a wedding in 2 days and it was yours. Yeah. And we're like, April, that's fantastic that you're here to film, but what are you doing here? Yeah. But we were like, wow, you're a trooper, and way to go, Charles, right? Like, anyways, so yeah, so it was like 2 days before. And then, but that one got like, you know, we actually basically got to the river and then it like, it totally chocolated up and we couldn't even fish, right? And so I don't know if we actually even fished together that day, but the one you're referring to, the one where we had to hike, cause I don't know if I realized how pregnant you actually were. So I'm like, oh, I said, you know, in the pre-planning thing, I'm like, well, there's bull trout down in this canyon and it's not a super bad hike. And I'm sure April will be able to do it. Right. Like, but I didn't realize how pregnant you were. And I think that I felt
a little bit bad.
It
was not the first trimester. I think I was showing, cause I think I remember trying to cut that out and filming.
I can't remember
how long it was, but I remember every step being like, why have I done this?
Yeah. But you were pretty good though, because even though, you know, obviously you were thinking that, we didn't hear very much of that or even any of that, I don't think. And then really it was our guide that kind of saved the day, because we caught a few bull trout down in that canyon, but then he's like, yeah, I've got a better spot. And then he like ran back to town and grabbed his jet boat. And then we like hopped, which probably is what we should have done to begin with, right? Like we totally should have like just been like, oh yeah, April's pregnant. Why don't we just hop in a boat and like actually fish out of a boat? Cause that would have been smart. But yeah, but you know, filming with us, we're not always like hyper intelligent, right? We're always just like, oh, where are we gonna go fishing? And
I will attest to that.
Yeah. You know what though?
Go ahead.
You know what though? I have to say, I sold myself short a little bit, because there's a lot of thought that we put into filming. But I think that when we actually get there, it's like, it's more like, okay, it's more like, you know, you just want to fish, right? And so there's a part of my brain that like shuts off, because I'm like, oh, I just gotta catch fish now. Anyways, yeah, the older I get, the better I'm getting at like not allowing that part of my brain to shut down, just like letting the thinking part of my brain carry on even while I'm fishing. But I don't know. Anyways,
well, let's provide some context here. So Derek Bird, part of the infamous Bird family.
Yes,
infamous sounds like it's bad, but a lot of people know the Bird family. I would say more people know your brother than you, as far
That's
as
true.
You know. Being for front facing in the fly fishing industry. So let's just provide a little bit of context here. So Fly Fusion Magazine, that has been a family business from the beginning. I don't know. I'm hoping you'll tell me more about how that all started.
Yeah, for sure. It was, oh man. And you know what? I should really know the answer to this, April. Like I should actually know the year that we started, but it was like, I think it was around 2003. That we got going, and it was actually the result of a trade show, and because my family started like this kind of Western Canadian fly fishing exposition, and then there they realized that my brother I believe that wanted to actually like do a magazine that kind of went along with that. But then once we actually got it started, we're like, oh, it doesn't have to be a trade magazine. Like we can actually like there's, you know, there's space in Canada for like a full on like fly fishing magazine. Right. And so, so he actually called me and he said, okay, I've got this idea. And so we went back and forth. I was really wary at first because, and I don't know if you're like this, April, but my guess is a lot of fly anglers are, and I know that this sounds really hypocritical because I do spend time in front of a camera, you know, out like filming kind of different locations, but I think in my kind of youthful naivety, like back when I was however old I was when things got started, I didn't want it to be like this magazine that kind of just, just went and kind of showed all these different destinations, because I really started to see, and it probably was happening before, but I really started to see it kind of in my, I would say when I got to university, where I saw like some of my favorite fishing places really start to become popularized. And I struggled a little bit with that, even though, you know, I know that there's arguments on the other side for, you know, popularizing a fishery. I understand that. But I think in my kind of youthfulness, I struggle with that. And so I said to Chris, I said, I'd love to join you and help you out. But I'd like for it to be more instructional, the magazine, rather than destination based. And so that became a real focus. And it really struck a nerve, which you can attest to this because of what you've got going, right? With, you know, with Anchored Outdoors and like how you're very, like there's a, you know, with your master classes, you're very, like there's a lot of instruction that goes along with what you do. And people really, like they really gravitate towards that. I think everybody, you know, whether it be fly fishing or hunting or whatever it is, there's always more that you can know, right? And so we became, like the magazine kind of became this place where we went out and found like some of the, what I would consider kind of some of the best, like the most knowledgeable of the most knowledgeable. And we kind of featured their ideas. And then we found really good photographers to go along with their good ideas. And it really kind of, it took off. It really did. Some people ask us about the name, like, oh, you know, where'd you guys get the name from? It was literally, and you know this because we've talked about creativity a lot before, but it was literally like, you know, when you're kind of in a creative mindset where you're trying to come up with ideas, and it was just one of those like lots of back and forth. We had a few different partners at first with the magazine, and so we're all kind of firing around names for the magazine, and it was like one night kind of before bed, I had fired off a few to different people. At that time, it was only email, and I'd fired off a few names, and it was kind of like, you know, day or two or three before you'd hear back and be like, oh no, you know, probably not that one. That's not like, you know, I don't think that's a great name. And so there was a few of those that happened. And then one night I was kind of like just laying in bed, and I'm like, I started to be like, fly, you know, fly fishing, fly. And so I started to do that kind of as we do, like creative types start to do when they're just kind of like, you know, when their brain finally gets to rest, right? That's kind of when things really start to happen. And so that's what happened. I was just like, I kind of like, it was kind of like this, you know, fly fusion. Oh, that has a nice ring to it, right? Like it has this kind of like, yeah, it had this like, you know, this kind of confusion of words that went along that kind of said everything that we wanted to say. And so I emailed everybody when I got up the next morning, all of our partners and stuff. And I said, here's another one. And that was funny because when I sent that one out, within 10 minutes, everybody was back. Immediate. Yep, that's it. That's the one, right? And so it was very immediate.
I can just see Chris now. I can see Chris. Yes.
Yes. Yeah, because he's very much like that, right? Like I'm like, you know, we look a lot alike, but we are very, like our personalities are very, very different. And he's like, you know, he's the risk taker. I'm not, right? I'm kind of that, you know, I'm a creative type, and he's, you know, it's not that he's not creative, but he's got creativity and he's got, you know, vision and foresight, and he's not afraid to like, to kind of take that step and you know, fail at times or maybe sometimes succeed, right? And I think that's something that I've actually had to learn, is to be okay with failure, right? And to be okay with, you know, with criticism. That's been a learning curve for me kind of my whole life. And the more I've kind of written and the more I've kind of like allowed kind of some of my creativity to seep out there, the more I've become okay with like, with realizing that especially creatively, part of creativity and having a voice kind of in a public sphere is like part of it is kind of like, yeah, we need an audience or we desire an audience. But part of it is because of who we are, right? It's just like, that's just who I am. Like I have to create things. I have to write things. I have to, you know, I have to do that. That's who I am. And so whether it's praise or criticism that I get as a result of that, that's very secondary for me. But I had to learn that too. So anyways, and I suspect that you, like would have some understanding of that as well, right? Because you're very much in the public eye, far more than I am, but you're very much in the public eye. And when you're in the public eye, you do get a little bit of criticism here or there, and you get praise, and you can't like, and you can't if you allow yourself to kind of to be formed by that, you'll actually be destroyed by it. Whether it's the praise or the criticism, you'll be destroyed on either side. And so it's more of no, this is who I am. This is what I'm doing. And some people are going to like it. Maybe some people will love it. And maybe some people won't. But that's okay, because this is just what I'm doing. Right? And yeah. So there's very much a calm in that. Anyways, I got off track because you're like, oh, the magazine and the family.
No, that's all right. But as long as you know that you're doing your best, right? Like, obviously, there's going to be things looking back that you wish that you had done differently. I don't know if you've experienced that. I have. And I just have to ask myself, well, did you do your best? Yeah. And whether, again, that's, you know, critiqued or praised, is it's really out of my control. And
right.
I've just done my best.
Yeah. And I think too, like, and with that concept too, of kind of doing your best at things, I think that one thing, that is scarily absent in kind of in our culture, like in kind of a raising of kind of the next generation. And it obviously maybe wasn't even there when kind of I was around or when I was kind of growing up either, but just that concept that it's okay to try your hardest at something and still fail. It's very much okay to have that happen, to like work your hardest and come up short. And then the important thing is to have the tools to actually be able to navigate through that when you get to that point, because that's like, because that feels very much like an end, but really it's the very beginning of truly anything good that's about to happen. Like if you can get past that, right? That kind of like, oh man, I've just been kicked in the face so hard, right?
But so what is your, you're a writer. And yeah. What is your definition then? This is fascinating to me. What is your definition of failure?
That's a really good question. Well, I think there's different levels of failure, really. I think that there's, you know, that there's individual failure. I think that there's, you know, societal failure. I think that there's like, you know, everything in between that as well. But like individual failure, I would say is getting to that point of kind of where we would say, I haven't succeeded. And then backing off and going, well, I guess I'm just not good enough, right? Like, I guess I just can't. I guess I, like, to me, that's more, that would be the definition of failure, because you'll never know how far you can push. And the thing is that you know, we're very individualistic, which is good. That's not a bad thing. But sometimes, even you know, as creative types, sometimes we need people to help us get past that. And I think that's where, you know, that's where a level of pride has to be squashed, right? Where we're like, oh man, I really need a mentor, or I really need to learn more here. I really need to go out and figure out how I can become better at this shortcoming. You know, if we, you know, often we try to run away from our shortcomings, and rightfully so, right? They're scary. It's scary to be, you know, to have that, or to admit to ourselves that we have shortcomings. It can be very scary to do that. But really, it doesn't matter how good we are at something, even if we're gifted at something, if we head out in a direction, we're still going to have some shortcomings in that direction. None of us are like, you know, even whether it be a sports figure or, you know, whatever, nobody's perfect in kind of anything that they do. Like, nobody is. And that's a realization that's like a nice realization to come to, or a calming realization to come to, because then you can be like, well, you know what? I need a few people, right? I need people to mentor me. I need people to help me past this. Now there's things that we can do that we're just really genuinely crappy at, right? That we're just like absolute garbage at. I'm not necessarily talking about that. I'm talking about the things that we believe that we're good at, right? And that
Yeah,
we,
yeah.
yeah.
But you know, when I was 18, I loved business books and, you know, self-improvement books. And
Yeah.
when I was 18, the first one that I read was this old ratty copy of Think and Grow Rich that my dad gave to
Yeah.
me. And that I think was the best book I possibly could have read straight out of high school because I never saw failure the same again. It was always in my mind, there was always a journey, right? I was here and I wanted to be here. And
Nice.
so
Yeah.
even though it was failure, it was failing forward because I
Right.
learned what to do, whether it was going to be a pivot or whether it was just simply what to not do again. It was
Yeah.
failing forward. Sometimes it was humiliating.
Yeah.
I haven't figured out how to escape the humiliation yet. I think that comes within yourself, which is being again, okay, knowing that you've done your best. But failing forward, I think, is a great way to just really embrace that. Yes, it didn't go as planned, but you still are farther ahead than
Right.
maybe you would have been.
And that's good that you discovered that when you did. Like, kudos to your dad, right, for giving you that book. Because I think that that's like, you know, discovering that at that age probably has a lot to do with kind of where you're at now, right?
I
Because,
think
you
so,
know,
yeah.
for sure, yeah. Because there's like, yeah, because there's things that, you know, there's things that, yeah, you pick those things up along the way. And for some reason, you know, whether it's cultural or whether it's, you know, innate in our human nature, it's more of a rarity to come across people that, you know, that can, you know, get kicked in the face or whatever it is, and then kind of get up and keep going in the direction that they want to go, right? So yeah, so anyways, I think that's a really, you know, that was a very positive lesson that you could learn. And obviously you're somebody that, actually I know this because we've chatted before, but you're somebody that can learn from books, and you do that a lot, right? There's a lot of reading that you do. And yeah, so I think that's really positive, because sometimes we don't have, you know, we don't have certain role models in our lives, or we don't have, you know, somebody that's kind of maybe forged that path that we are going to walk through our lives. And so we have to, you know, we have to read books, or we have to find podcasts, or we have to, you know, pick up a magazine, or we have to do whatever, right? And so anyways, yeah.
So back to the mag but and actually before I dive back into the magazine, I will just preface that with saying it's also very dangerous to figure that out at 18, 19, 20, 21, 22,
Right.
because as a young adult, when you pair that confidence with your limited knowledge of the world
Oh.
and insight into, you know, your own self and just maybe how ignorant and maybe arrogant you are, it can be a very dangerous mix. So just a side note, warning from experience for young people listening,
Yeah,
that
that's a fantastic or a
proceed with
fantastic
caution.
side note. Yeah, right? Because yeah,
You think
because
you're great when you're 25. I mean, oh, I look back now and I probably shouldn't have known all those things so early on because I was too young and arrogant to know my own limitations.
Right. Yeah, there is that, right? Where we're like, and I think that's where, you know, regrets can maybe take root and things like that, is when we look back at how much we thought we knew at a certain stage in life.
It's so embarrassing.
But I think it's like, it's so important. Otherwise cultures just wouldn't change. Do you know what I mean? They'd become stagnant. They really would. If you don't have these brash, self-confident, you know, like upper level teenagers / 20s, if you don't have those people that are like, that don't get the full spectrum, but they don't even know that they don't get the full spectrum, I think that cultures would just stagnate like 100%. And so, because I've thought about that before, where I'm just like, why is that? Why was I so confident when I was like 21 or 25? Why was I so confident then? And really looking back, I knew so little, right? But I just thought I just had infinite wisdom at that age. but thinking back, that's why, or what I believe anyways, is that it needs to be there. It's part of, you know, essentially it's part of our design, right? It's part of like our brains haven't maybe fully developed in certain areas, and yet we believe that we know most things, or maybe everything. So anyways.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
What a good point. So yeah. Your parents were also involved in the magazine. And just for people who don't know, you were a full-time teacher. I mean, are you still teaching?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. So, but I've been on and off a little bit, right? So, when was it? Probably about 6 years ago or 7 years ago, I took a sabbatical from teaching, and I worked full time for the magazine. So yeah, so it, and which was a great experience. It was really, really good. And you know, I got to kind of drink from all the you know, all the full cup of the magazine at that point, I would say, working for it full time. You know, I did quite a few trips, like, you know, where a rod company would call up the magazine and say, oh yeah, you know, do you want to send somebody out? We're like, we're going to go up to Alaska and, you know, fish for a week, and we need to test out this new rod line. Do you want to send somebody along? So I was the one that would get to go on those things. Right. And it was like, when I'm teaching full time, I can't just drop everything and do that. And so really it was like, it kind of became like that kind of dream job in a way, where it was just like, doing that, going on, like, you know, media trips where, you know, where all these other, you know, magazine types or like social influencers would be, and kind of just hanging out with all these, you know, all these people that share a very similar passion. And, you know, some of them are your competitors, and so you don't really know how everybody's going to kind of react and respond right away. And so there was that dynamic, but it was really cool, like just going, you know, steelheading with some of those guys or some of those people. And yeah, just testing out, you know, different rods. And anyway, so that was pretty cool. But so I did that for a number of years. I think it was 4 years where I just worked full time. I mean, I've been with the magazine right from its inception. I've written for it right from the very start, written and edited right from the very start all the way till today. But the full time, yeah, it was pretty cool that way to be able to do that. I am back teaching full time now. But that's an interesting, and I don't think I've ever shared this before. So way to go, April. But anyways, I think that because I would have people come up to me like all the time, especially when I was working full time for the magazine, and just go, you have my dream job. Like, you literally have my dream job. If I could do anything, like, there was one guy that I met, and I can't remember if it was out on the river or where it was, but maybe it was like picking up kids from school. I don't know. I can't remember. Anyways, he came up and he just said, Derek, he said, I was, you know, I'm in the middle of like switching careers right now, and my career counselor asked me, like, what job do you want? And he went, well, do you know Derek Bird? I want his job. That's the job I want. So there was people that were like, yeah, no, I want to do that. But the crazy thing was is that there was part of me, and I don't know if it was the crazy part of me, but there was part of me that had a lot of trouble reconciling kind of working full-time in the pastime that I'm most passionate about. There was part of me that had trouble reconciling that, right? Where it was like, I didn't know, I just didn't know if I could keep working at that kind of full-time, because I didn't want it to ruin my love for fly fishing. Because I felt like fly fishing is like, it's not an escape for me, but it is in a way. It's like, I don't know how to explain it. Anyways, I didn't want it to ruin that. And I felt like it could, go in that direction. And so, and I missed teaching horribly. Like I did, I loved teaching. I love the, you know, the day-to-day interaction. I love, you know, I love literature. I love kind of delving into things with students like that. And so, so I missed teaching, and so I went back to teaching full time, and now I still work for the magazine, but it's not full time anymore. I write, and then if there's any film stuff, I said, oh yeah, I keep my name on the list for that, because I love going out filming. That's one of my favorite things. Yeah,
which is so funny, because to me you don't really have this real, what you would think of when you think of a filming personality or somebody who really loves being on television. But I guess it's just because it's not scripted and you get to just be yourself and have fun.
Yeah. Yes. That's so funny that you picked that up, April, because I have to say, and that it goes all the way back. You know, I've always said to, like, I don't know whether it's like my students or whoever I end up in a conversation with it, where we end up kind of in this place. But I always say, like, if you can't recognize kind of that inner child, like that you that, you know, used to play with trucks as a kid, or, you know, used to you know, kind of just go and play in the forest with your brothers or whatever. Like, I grew up on 5 acres and my brother and I just go and play in the forest. Like, if you can't recognize that kid when you're, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 or 70, I think that there's something that, you know, there's something not necessarily wrong, but I think that you should be able to recognize that kid. And so anyways, that was one thing that, just that I totally lost my train of thought now.
Oh, just filming, being on television.
Oh yeah. Filming. Yeah. Yeah. So as a kid, I was such a shy kid. And I think that maybe that's what you pick up because generally I don't like kind of being in front of crowds, and I don't like the attention of like kind of being center of attention. I don't like that. Which is really a conundrum. But I haven't figured out why it is, except that I have like this kind of like, I don't know. It's like this, I don't know if divergent personality, I don't know if that's the right terminology, but I have it where it's like, I don't like the limelight. I've always been shy, but I have this, like, I have this skill set where I communicate, where that's kind of my, I don't know if you can call it my sweet spot. That's what I enjoy doing, where I like to communicate with people and share ideas and talk through things. And like, I love that. And so basically my whole life is a bit of a conundrum in that way. Right.
because, or just that you do better one-on-one than maybe in a group setting.
Well, yeah.
And I think that's what's so special about your writing too, as a side note, is I feel like, when I read your writing, I feel like you are speaking to me. And whether it's in fiction or through the column in the magazine, I definitely feel like you're not speaking to the masses, but I feel like you're speaking to me. So maybe your sweet spot, if you will, is communicating in a more intimate setting.
Oh, thank you for that. I appreciate that actually very much because, you know what? I really appreciate that statement because I believe that I have this, you know, this thought about kind of art and communication, and it's that, and I think that the thought has emerged because of where we're off to culturally, and it's just that I hope that culturally we never get too far away from the fact that we're more intricately connected than I think that we realize, And I think that that's what makes kind of art what it is, or that's what makes kind of a more mass communication what it is that we, you know, when we read something, you know, whether it be a novel or, or a nonfiction book or whatever, when we read something and we're like, and something connects with us, it's because somebody else actually has that same idea, and they're able to express it, and it kind of opens up your eyes to something that exists somewhere within you already. I believe it exists somewhere within you already, and you're like, oh my goodness. Like, so just as an example, because that to me is quite abstract, but just as an example, I can remember everything about seeing the movie A River Runs Through It for the first time. I think I was 20 at the time when it came out. So it was 1993. And I can remember sitting in the movie theater and just thinking, like, between Robert Redford and Norman McLean, like, they told a story that I identified with so many different parts of it, right? Like I felt like, and again, like, to use what you just said, I felt like they were communicating like directly to me, right? I felt like they made the movie just for me. You know, what's funny, April, too, I remember very much that. And I remember just sitting in the movie theater afterwards, after the credits were rolling, and just not even wanting to move, just wanting to just like, I wish that there was more of it. I just wanted it to keep, like, to keep happening. I wanted the story to keep happening. So when I wrote this novel that I wrote, which I, at some point I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit, but when I wrote it, I actually sent, there's a fella that I've crossed paths with in the last few years because of the film festival, who works directly for Robert Redford. And so I emailed him one day. I'm like, can I send a copy of my book? I'd like to send a signed copy to Robert Redford. And so I wrote an inscription on the inside, saying, I remember everything about the movie. So just thank you. Thank you for telling the story the way that you told the story. So I wrote that on the inside of the cover of my book, and I haven't heard back from him. But anyways, that's neither here nor there. So I hope he got it, but if not, anyways, yeah. So that's, yeah, I think that there's this underlying, common kind of, I don't know what you'd even call it. There's this underlying common humanity, and that's what makes art what it is. And that's what makes, whether it's doing what you're doing and communicating to, this mass audience or whatever it is, there's this underlying kind of common thread that runs through humanity. And are we unique? 100%. We're all so unique, and we've all got our own journeys to take. And I understand that. But then on the other side, there's a reason why we're drawn to certain pieces of literature. There's a reason why we're drawn to certain pieces of art. There's a reason why we're drawn to certain movies. And why we feel like those movies communicated specifically to us, or that book communicated specifically to us. And it's because we share, we share a common humanity, and I love that. And so being able to tap into that at times, and sometimes I fail, sometimes I really miss the mark, and I understand that, and I've walked that bridge before, but I will again, because, that's part of it. Sometimes we just, we fully miss the mark, but it's part of it, right? That's part of humanity as well. We all know what it's like to, to fail and get back up. We all know what it's like to, to succeed and feel good about it, right?
So you've just segued me perfectly into art and literature and fly fishing.
Okay, yeah.
Which is obviously something that you are, I believe that you, how do I say this? I almost feel like you're hanging on for dear life to art and literature and fly fishing. And it's funny, yeah, because reading a lot of the books, even dating back to the late 1800s, all throughout the 1900s, it was very artistic.
Yeah.
And I know that over the last decade, 20 years or so, there's been a bit of a shift. Do you still feel like you're talking to the same audience, or do you feel like you're talking to people who maybe don't necessarily hear you or want to hear you?
Yeah. Oh man, April, what a great question, man. That's so good. So yes and no. There's a whole bunch of different answers to that question you just asked. There's been a shift culturally, right? Since Industrial Revolution, kind of scientific revolution, there's been a shift culturally, and that's why we just want to be imbued with knowledge, right? Where we want to know more when we're, as fly anglers, where we feel like, we have all of this information at our fingertips, and so we want to know more. So yes, culture is kind of shifted from an artistic approach to some of the things that we do. It shifted I just need to know more time kind of approach, right? Where we want to break everything apart and put it back together so that we know how every segment or piece of our cast, we want to know kind of where the stop points of our cast need to begin and stop. And we want to know that we're fully stopping and accelerating 0 to 60. And we want to break down every single element and know every single element. And I think that that's that culturally we had to do that. And I think that that's a really positive, a very positive thing. Our desire to know more, our collective conscious, our collective brains, we haven't even begun to scratch the surface of all the things that we're going to discover. And that includes fly fishing as well, right? There's just so much to always discover. And I think that's one of the reasons that you know, I'm drawn to it and you're drawn to it, is that, you know, there's just kind of this lifetime of learning that goes along with it. But so, you know, but there's this element, and I think that it's where, it's kind of where I exist. And sometimes I'm like, why do I exist here? Sometimes I get frustrated with myself, but because I don't know if it's a message that everybody necessarily wants to hear right now. I don't know if kind of the artistic message is necessarily the one, because I think that, again, I think that we've kind of gravitated away from that. But as somebody that, you know, that has a story to tell, I think that if I can tie into, and not that I try to do that, it's just kind of the way my stories kind of come together. If I can, you know, if I can explore that and kind of even, you know, awaken maybe a few people kind of back to like not even the beauty of our pastime, but just the some of the bigger questions of our pastime, right? Like, I don't know, just the, you know, why do I feel so small when I'm like out in nature, right? When I'm standing below like massive peaks and standing in a river that's, you know, that has trout in it and has like, you know, a blue wing olive hatch coming off. Like, why do I feel like, you know, why do I feel small and yet invited to that kind of party, right? Why do I, you know, why is that? I don't know. I have no clue why, but I know that there's kind of a beauty that exists there that needs to be captured. It needs to be written about. It begs to be written about in a way that's not just kind of like, that's not just utterly scientific. I think if we go through kind of life and we're always just breaking things apart down to the kind of their, you know, their most minute detail, I think we forget that, you know, that beauty is comprised of kind of all of these different components and parts. And when we're just stuck in the parts, we forget about kind of the beauty that exists. And so anyways, that's kind of what my storytelling does, or my writing does, or even when we're out filming, you know, the TV shows and stuff, even when we're out filming, that's part of what, like, my desire is to capture part of that. And it's definitely, it finds an audience. It's just not, maybe it's not always the audience that I hope it will, you know, it'll find, because I think sometimes it's hard to tap into that, especially, like I said, because culturally, we've kind of walked away a little bit from that. And part of it's probably our own fault. You know, the arts don't pay a lot, right? Like that, you know, whereas science is, you know, you can earn a better paycheck in the sciences and maybe not quite as much of a paycheck in the arts, unless you're kind of the elite of the elite of the elite actors type thing.
Coming up, Derek and I continue our conversation. Again, thank you to South Dakota for supporting this episode of Anchored. For more than 100 years, pheasant hunting has been a storied South Dakota tradition. Now, for the next century, South Dakota is focused on expanding pheasant hunting's horizons, welcoming more sportswomen to the field, giving them a greater voice in the hunting community. That's a legacy to stand the test of time.
Does that answer your question, April?
It does. And it's funny. There's two different parts, two different things I wanted to mention on that. So one, it's funny because you're right. We're in an era where we really want to know everything about everything, but we want to know it as fast as possible, right?
So yes, we do.
It's contradictory. But just back to the arts and fly fishing subject, you know, money, paychecks. So
right.
With the
okay.
magazine.
Yeah.
And even yeah. with what I do, like when I started Anchored Outdoors, I wanted to have it be just profile pieces of all my guests and telling their story and sending in video crews and, you know, or camera guys
right.
to showcase amazing lifestyles. But the reality is that it's impossible to make your money back off of it. And I'm not independently wealthy. I can't go about doing that. Same with the magazine. I'm sure the magazine would have been a wonderful way to focus on the arts, but you may not have sold as many. So with your books, do you feel a freedom to not have to focus on instruction or science?
Oh yeah, I totally do. Although, like in my novel that's just come out, I'll name it Last Summer on the Sage, it's called. There are elements in it that are very like, that are very, you know, I would say more scientific, right? That, you know, that name certain bugs. And like one of the things, if you, you know, if you do go out and buy it or read it, it's like, you'll notice that, you know, the hatch chart kind of follows perfectly through the narrative, right? Like, it's like, oh, like the main character, Ryan, he's, you know, astute enough to know that, you know, when he kind of like is putting this, when he's tying on like a terrestrial, like a, you know, say like a hopper or something, he knows that his summer's coming to an end, right? He knows that, you know, that this will be his last summer fishing this, because he's off to the big city, he's off to university. And so it kind of like, he reflects on that as he's going through. But I do feel that very much, April, in the storytelling that I'm doing, specifically in this novel, Last Summer on the Sage. I feel like there's like kind of this like ultimate freedom to just be a storyteller. And that's like one of the things that I love doing the most. Like when I sit down and talk with people, I love listening to people's stories. And I love telling stories. And like the book that I just wrote, it has like little segments or little pieces of stories that have happened to me while I've been growing up. But there's this freedom in fiction where we can kind of take that story and we can kind of do whatever we want with it, right? And we can be creative with it. And one of the characters in the book, his name is Jack. And this is always a difficult story for me to tell, but Jack is a character. So he's a bit of an older character in the book. And his character, I had him like when I started writing the actual like first draft and stuff, you know, I had this plot arc, I had Jack's character all kind of lined up. But when I started writing Jack's character, I just fell in love with his character because his character is based on, and this is tough for me to say, and I promise I won't cry on your podcast, but this is tough for me to say, but there have been people in my life that I either wasn't able to connect with, or I made maybe a dumb decision when I was younger and I thought I was too young to maybe make a difference and connect with somebody in a certain way. And so Jack's character is this character of, it's kind of a, you know, it's a character of redemption, essentially, is what it is. It's like, you know, we're drawn to stories of redemption, like, you know, maybe like The Green Mile or, you know, movies like that. We're drawn to that. And Jack's character is very much that character. And it's primarily based on two people. But the one that I'm most comfortable talking about is my grandfather. My grandfather was a fly fisherman, and I never fly fished with him. And it was because of, you know, just some family upheaval that happened. And I didn't actually get to know my grandfather until I was 17. And I had taken, you know, my car at the time, and I had driven up to this one lake that I wanted to fish. I was all by myself. And I was just like, and I knew that my grandfather had a cabin at the next lake up, on the dirt road the next lake up. I'd heard that he had a cabin at the end of this lake. And I just was like, I don't care. Like, I'm just going to go and see him. Like, I'm just going to go and like see him and introduce myself to him. And so I did. So I like, after I'd finished fishing, I packed up a little bit early and I drove up to the next lake and I found where the cabins were at the end of this lake. And I started knocking on a few doors, and I think I only had to knock on a couple, and somebody's like, oh yeah, you know, Jack, he has the cabin just over there. And so I remember feeling really, really nervous, right? And I walked up to his door and I knocked on the door, and the door opened, and I had like, on the way up, you know how you have like these speeches, like where you're like, this is what I'm going to say, you know? And I got up to the door and I knocked, and he opened the door, and I looked like, and I looked at him and I'm like, oh my goodness, that's me when I'm like 75 years old. Like, that's like he is me. Like, we're like spitting images of one another. And I just went, he kind of just stood there and he stared at me, and I went, hey. Like, that's all that came out was, hey. And he went, he looked at me and he's all, he kind of like shook his head a little bit. He's all, hey, like kind of like, yeah, hello. And then he went, he stared at me and it was really uncomfortable for whatever it was, 2 seconds. And then he was like, yeah, you're going to have to refresh my memory. I don't know who you are. And I went, I said, I'm your grandson. And he's like, oh, he said, come on in. And so he invited me in and we sat there. We probably had this like 2 or 3 hour conversation, April, where we just sat there and we talked and he was like, in his old age, he was like, I would put him in the grumpy old camp kind of man type thing. It was very entertaining to sit and listen to all of the things that he was unhappy about. It was very entertaining. But I often thought, like, after that, I often thought of like all those years that I missed, you know, as a kid, like where I could have gone, you know, fly fishing with grandpa. Right. One of my characters, one of my favorite characters in the novel is actually kind of loosely based on him and one or two other people that I wish I would have had kind of more time with. And so with that character in the novel, I very much allow for that character in the story to very much be redeemed and very much like just kind of get to a place where they're able to look back on their life and kind of not regret and kind of like overcome certain hurdles and allow for their story to be like a, you know, a story where the pieces come back together, where yeah, maybe life kind of dealt them a crappy hand, but the hand that they have that they're holding right at that moment at the end of the story is a happy one, right? So anyways, he became kind of one of my favorite characters. He's, you know, he's this kind of this recluse who has this cabin up in the middle of nowhere, and he's kind of forced to, he ends up being forced to interact with the main character because of an unfortunate circumstance. He's kind of forced out of his cabin, and he's just this wealth of information and knowledge, and he grows as he becomes kind of this mentor to the main character. And it's like, anyways, I love that, and I don't know if there's room for that in kind of like in fly fishing, like that kind of a story, but it is, it's a story of fly fishing. Like the main character, he's just like this kid that like just kind of like that's how he feels alive, right? He fly fishes, and that's what he does with his two best friends, his best friend and then his best friend's younger sister, who becomes who's like a year or two younger, who becomes kind of a love interest towards the end as well. Now I'm giving away too much, but anyways, but it's like the main character Ryan, he just kind of soaks up life, and that's how he does it. He does it on the river, right? Like that's where he feels alive, and he's trying to do that as much as he can before he heads off to kind of the big city and goes to university, before he feels like he's going to lose that, right? And because we don't, like at that age, you know, we don't know what's going to happen in 3 years or 4 years or 5 years. We don't know that. And so, I think anybody that's like, and here are the touch points in it, like anybody that loves fly fishing will love this. And anybody who doesn't love fly fishing actually loves this novel too. I've talked to a few people who don't fly fish who it was probably one of the most heartwarming things that anybody's ever said to me. They were like, I don't fly fish, but so-and-so gave me the novel and they told me I had to read it, and I read it, and now I want to fly fish. And I was just like, oh my goodness, like that's just so meaningful for me. But I think anybody who like loves fly fishing would love this story. Anybody who knows what it's like to kind of like fall in love at 17 and think it's like the biggest thing in the entire world would love this story. Anybody that like that feels like they've kind of maybe lost a section of their life for whatever reason and kind of gain it back, or have the hope to gain life back and kind of feel like they're in control of portions of their life at least, would love this story. I said to somebody the other day, I'm like, oh, and here I am, like, I'm not really good at promoting my stuff, because I just kind of write it and then I move on. I'm working on another novel right now, but it's like, but I said to somebody after some of the like just astoundingly positive feedback that I'm getting from people that have read it, I said to somebody the other day, I was like, I feel like I feel like as a Flangler, you have a choice. It's like, do you want to be the person who this is recommended to, or do you want to recommend it to somebody else? Because at some point you're going to read it. So anyways, that sounds way overconfident, but I'm kind of hoping for that.
Well, look, I read the first chapter of that book and I genuinely enjoyed it. I wanted to know what happened next.
Oh yeah. So just wait till you get to chapter 10. So the first few chapters are like, the first few chapters are good, but it really, I'm setting up the story. When you get to kind of like chapters 8, 9, 10, it's like, it becomes like, I don't know, it just becomes kind of like encompassing because I've written parallel plots. Parallel plots are just kind of like, they are what they sound, right? They're kind of like these two plots that kind of move along together. And any time where there's parallel plots, they have to come together at some point. And I kind of love where the parallel plots come together, but I'm biased. So
yeah, that's like cool that you've planning when you were, when oh, you were writing it, was, it, did you have to map it all out?
Yeah. Oh, it was, yeah, it was so much planning. It was like, and yeah, I wrote kind of this massive plot arc and I had kind of these two plots that kind of run through the whole, they run through the whole novel and they're very integral to the novel. The novel actually starts out not on a river, but the novel starts out in a, you know, in a classroom. It starts out, this teacher, he's teaching the novel to his class. And there's like one kid in the class who's excited about it because the kid fly fishes, right? And so he's just like so excited about it. And so the teacher's like trying to cultivate some excitement by telling them, well, it's not just about fly fishing, right? It's about fly fishing, but it's about, you know, it's about kind of the essential aspects of life, right? It's about, you know, trying to figure out what you're going to do with your life and trying to figure out kind of how you're going to make an impact with your life and you know, trying to understand and navigate kind of the relationships that you have as you go through your life. And yeah, it's like, it's all about fly fishing, but it's all about those other things too. And it's kind of woven together. And so that's how the novel starts out. It starts out in the classroom. And
oh, maybe it wasn't chapter one that I read. I read the chapter, I don't want to give too much away, but he and his girlfriend come across some nefarious characters. What chapter?
Yes, yes. That's chapter two. So it starts out very much like kind of, I wanted to get started like kind of right in the action, right? And so it's not his girlfriend but it's his best friend's younger sister, and they end up going like fishing together. It's kind of opening day on their favorite river, and so they go out after work and they run into some nefarious characters who just happen to be, and not that I'm trying to demonize anybody that fishes, but they just happen to be like bait chuckers, right? Like guys that, you know, sit under the bridges. And I feel like I'm safe on your podcast by saying that. If I'm like on just a full fishing podcast, I would never demonize anybody, but they're demonized in the novel. Yeah. They're the antagonist. Yeah.
There's just no room for a backcast under a bridge. And so that's where the gnarly characters gather.
Yeah, that's exactly
it. It was a while when I read it. So when did the book go live and where can people find it?
Yeah, well, I sent it. So I did. I sent it to you. I think it was last year. I sent you like a kind of a pre, you know, whatever. I can't remember what we call it. Anyways, I sent you like a few chapters, like a preview so that you could write a little blurb. So there's a nice blurb on the back from you. And yeah, so you can get it. You can go to, you know, Fly Fusion Magazine, to the store. Like there's a button you can click on and hit store, and you can find it in there under books. There's a few books that Fly Fusion Mag sells, and they're the ones that published it. You can also go onto Amazon, and on Amazon, it's like, if you type in Last Summer on the Sage and my name, Derek Bird, it'll come up and you can like purchase it on Amazon. And yeah, so yeah.
Can you,
so
that's can where you get it in it. An ebook? What's your opinion on the whole ebook thing as a publisher?
Yeah. Yeah, no, you can get it on, yeah, you can get it on Kindle or, yeah, an ebook as well. You can purchase it that way. I love, like, I'm still old school, right? So I love having that, like, paper copy. And pages. I love being able to, like, yeah, I love being able to kind of put that up in my office after I've, you know, after I've finished a, you know, a book or something like that. So I'm old school that way. But yeah, there's, I mean, there's so many benefits to just buying, like, an ebook too, right? So, yeah, yeah.
So did you ever get to fish with your grandpa?
Oh, good question. I never did, but there is a kind of a happy ending to that story. I mean, besides the fact that we would just kind of, that we would sit and chat, and that wasn't the first time that I stopped by after that. Every time I'd go up and fish that lake, I'd go by my grandpa's cabin to see if he was there. When he passed away, he actually got to, there were times where I'd go back. I live on Vancouver Island now. There were times where I'd go back to the Kootenays and when he was still alive, and he got to meet, you know, my wife and my kids, and which was really, really cool. And just shortly before he passed away, I believe it was before he passed away, that he gave me his, I think it was like a 1956 or 58 Hardy Knockabout split cane fly rod. So I inherited that from him. Yeah, I inherited that from him, and it was like, I still have it. And yeah, I have, it's like, it's on my to-do list to put it up in my office, but it's still not up yet. And it, which is awful because that's where it needs to go. But yeah, I inherited that from him. I fished with it a few times just to say that, you know, I've held the same cork and fished the same fly rod as my grandpa. But yeah. So when people ask me like, why I fish, I'm like, I think I'm kind of almost too old to answer the question now. I'm like, cause I like it, but no, I think that it's like, it's part of, I don't know, it's part of my DNA, like knowing that my grandfather fished and, that my dad is like, I mean, that's what we used to do, right? I'm sure like lots of other people who fish, that's what we used to do. My dad would pull out the topo maps, the topographical maps. And, you know, just before the weekend, we'd sit there as kids and just kind of stare at it and be like, yeah, my dad'd be like, oh, we're going here this weekend. I'd just be like, oh man, like I could hardly wait, right? I'd just be like so excited. So that's, yeah.
You just said something really interesting though that just kind of piqued my interest. You just said you're almost too old to be able to answer the question, why do I fish? And it's funny, yeah, because obviously as someone who does interviews, that's a question that I feel like I should ask, but I'm just even bored asking it. Why is that?
Why?
Is it just because as you get older, we know too much? I don't know. You tell me.
Yeah. So first of all, I think that it's intentionally philosophical. And I think if you end up places that are philosophical, I think it's good. If you're intentionally philosophical, I think that people get bored. I think that people just are like, oh my goodness, when's this guy going to shut up? Right. I feel like I'm too old because I think that like in my 30s, I was always like, why do I do this? Why do I spend so much time doing this? I wanted to know why. And, you know, I tracked down a whole bunch of reasons as to why, you know, it's, you know, part of the hunter gatherer and, you know, all this stuff, but, which it could be, it very much could be, but really it's like the older I get, it's like, I just love being out there and I almost don't want to dissect it because it's like, because you're a thinker too, April. So it's like, you know, for people that think a lot, you can go too far. Like you can just go way too far and actually arrive way farther away from the actual answer the more you think about it. And so I've gotten to a place where I'm like, man, I just love it. Like I love when my holidays come. I love when my breaks come because I don't question what I'm going to do. Like I'm going to, you know, I've got like these trips all planned and I know exactly where I'm going. I'm going to my favorite spots. I like, you know, I know how I'm going to spend my time unwinding and just kind of like loving it. I was fishing with Jim McLennan the other day. I think you had Jim on your podcast at some point. Love the last little bit. He's one of my favorite people. He's like, he doesn't know this. I've never told him, but it's going to be out there now because I'm going to say it. But I have kind of a top five, like life heroes kind of like roster and he's on it. So I haven't even told them that, but now I've told everybody that because everybody listens to your podcast, right? So, so anyways, he's on that. I respect him so much. I think, anyways, we were out fishing and he said, we kind of started talking kind of philosophically a little bit. And have you figured out why you do this? And I said to him, I don't even know if I want to anymore, to figure out why. I said, I know why people like you and I do. And it's because even in our restful state, we don't want to rest. Do you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. like even when we're, you know, even when we feel like we need rest, we don't want to just sit and like, you know, mindlessly do something. We want to go out and kind of rest in a different way. And that's what fly fishing is, right? It's like you get to rest in this different way where you're still like, you're still trying to figure things out, right? And that's kind of me to the core. Like, but it's me resting to the core where I'm trying to figure something out, but it really doesn't matter whether I figure it out or not. Whereas some things in life, like I can't sleep unless I figure it out. Do you know what I mean? Because I feel like it's like really, really important to do that. And so, so the why, I just love it. Like, I just absolutely love it. I'm, you know, I'm kind of, if I live to 100, I'm like officially halfway. I'm kind of halfway along my journey this year. And I'm just like, I literally love it just as much as I did when I was a little kid, when I'd tie my fly rod to my bike with binder twine and ride to, you know, some lake or river with my brother or with my friends and, you know, just spend the day there, or, you know, no sunscreen, no water, nothing, no food, but just go and spend the day there, right? Because we're there to fish and that's what we did. And there's still that kid is still inside of me where I just like, I just love to just go and explore and figure things out and fish. And, you know, it's not the same, you know, it's not the same reckless passion. I don't think that we have the same reckless passion when we're 50 as we do when we're 30 and when we're 20 and when we're 12. But that the core of whatever it is still there. I still feel full, right? After I've gone and, you know, cast little midges or, you know, cast big Chernobyls or whatever it is, right? I feel full after I've done that. I feel like, you know, I could feel like I can face the world again, you know? You know exactly what I'm talking about because that's what you do too, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, and I think, like, for me, I think about it sometimes. You know, as a kid, there was no noise. There was no noise of societal expectations. There was no noise of just the world. It was just the art, just focusing on one thing, just trying to get that worm in front of the fish.
And still, right.
To this day, exactly what you said, I don't want to actually relax as in sit there and not move. I just want to shut the noise. And that's the way that I'm able to shut the
that's
noise.
That's the way you do it. Oh, that's
And that's
a really
always
good way
how
to put
I
it.
Shut the noise off. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
that's
speaking
a really
of
good
shutting,
way to put it.
Thank you. So shutting the noise off, you are about to be an empty nester. And it's interesting.
I am.
Reading, you know, we just did our big launch and I'm currently onboarding a bunch of new members and I'm reading their survey on why they've signed up. And a lot of them have done it because, or they've signed up and they're ready to learn more and focus on themselves because their kids have grown up and have gone, you know, they've left the nest. And it's interesting talking to a lot of these members and figuring out where they're at right now in their journey, because it's almost like they're starting over. Where are you at with that whole journey?
Oh man. So, So where I'm at is like, this is such a multi-layered question too, but it was like, it was something that I feared like all along. I mean, you raise your kids to be independent and you actually feel successful when they go out and they go away to university. But you also like, you invest so much of your life, right, into them that there's like this kind of like, you know, empty space kind of that exists after they leave. And yeah, so both of my sons are off to university and so, yeah, so my wife and I, we just, you know, recently and kind of in the last year became empty nesters. And I can remember So I've only really, and I'm embarrassed to say this, but I'm going to say it. I've only cried twice because of the whole empty nest thing. Because this part is embarrassing. I might like lose sleep about this tonight and text you and be like, April, you got to cut that part out. But anyways,
I'm not cutting it out. So be careful.
So the first time was the first time I cried about it was when the kids were like, they were probably like 5 and 7. And my wife and I, we took them to Toy Story 3. And it was funny because Toy Story 3 is all about, you know, the kid growing up and like giving away all his toys and heading off to university, right? And so we're like watching the movie, and in the theater, like everybody's kind of like at our stage in life at that point, right? And in the theater, people are like, I could hear people crying. And I'm just like, I did the guy thing, right? Where I was just like, I'm looking around because I could feel it in my throat, right? And I'm like, I'm not going to cry. This is just a dumb Pixar film, right? So I'm thinking that. So I like really pushed it down. I really had to work at pushing it down, right? When he's giving away all his like stuffed animals and heading off to university, people are like, ooh, you know, crying. And we get into the car, and my wife had been crying because that touched her very deeply as well. And we're starting to drive away, and she's like, are you okay, honey? And I'm like, I'm fine. I did the whole, I'm fine. And like a few minutes later, she's all, I don't think you're fine, hun. Like, do you need to talk about something? I'm like, honey, I'm fine. I'm like, totally fine. Kids are sitting in the back seat. I don't want to cry in front of my boys, right? And about like 10 minutes later, we're driving along, and I just let it all out. I'm like, our kids are going to grow up one day. And I like start to cry as I'm driving. They're going to grow up one day. They're going to like leave the house. And I don't know if I'll ever be ready for that. And so I had a good cry about it then. And then when it actually happened, I think after about 2 weeks, I kind of sobbed. I kind of like did the push it down thing again, and then, you know, trying to be strong for everybody. And then I just like, after about 2 weeks, I think I like had a day where they didn't come through the door, and they weren't going to be coming through the door for like months and months and months until the next summer or until Christmas or whatever. And I was just like, yeah, I sobbed, and then I kind of got it out, and then I was good. It was like, okay. And the great part about it is that my wife and I, we've been able to start to focus on each other again, which is wonderful, right? It's kind of like, well, that's why we got married, right? That's why we fell in love with each other, because you're awesome. So it's been like that, and it's been really nice that way. And it's like, and then I've got extra time because I'm not driving kids everywhere, and I'm not like, you know, driving them to soccer or basketball or, you know, it's been great. And so I've got extra time. I've got a little bit extra time, and I don't feel as guilty when I like, you know, run to the river after work one day and, you know, catch this hatch or that hatch. And, and I've got more time to write. And so I'm writing a ton, and yeah, it's been good. I'd never want them to leave, but I'm like, but that's why we do it, right? That's why we raise kids, so that they'll, you know, so that they'll head out and become independent and take over for us one day. Right. So anyways, I probably didn't really say anything like helpful to anybody who's like in the empty nester stage, but yeah.
But I just think it's so interesting how many people are in that stage. But you know, it's true. My girlfriend said it to me the other day, or a friend of mine said it to me the other day. She said, you know, there will be a day when it's the last time you ever pick your daughter up. There will just be a day when it's the last time. And that really resonates with me. You know, I'm in that stage. My daughter's almost 5. So I'm like, yes, I cannot wait for you to get out of this house. But then when I really look at it, it's daunting for sure. I'm definitely not watching Toy Story 3.
Yeah. Don't watch that. Yeah. Not at that age. Yeah. Do you find that you watch your, because it happens so much, you know, in such compressed time when kids are smaller, but they go through stages, right? And you kind of like, as a parent, I remember thinking like what the heck is happening? They're doing this and they never did that before. And then you kind of like figure it out whether it's reading something or talking to a friend who's like gone through it or whatever, you kind of figure it out and then you're kind of like, yeah, I got this, right? I got this. And then all of a sudden they hit a different stage and you're just like, okay, what's going on, right? And it's like, yeah, there's like, do you find that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I can't keep up, but I actually quite enjoy it. She keeps me on my feet. She is a mini me. You haven't met Adelaide yet, but.
No.
So I feel like, so while yes, I have a hard time keeping up with the stages, I know what the next stage is going to be, if that makes sense.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Because I was that person.
So yeah, there you go. So you have some understanding. Yeah.
To some degree, remember. It gets easier as she gets older, you know, and also
that's
my
true.
Mom. My mom kept a diary of her raising me up till I was a teenager.
Really? Wow.
And it's been interesting seeing the parallels there as well. So I feel like mom's kind of given me a heads up on what to expect. My mom's been a great teammate with all this.
Yeah. Well, that's great that she kept that. That would help a lot, especially since you have a mini you. So.
But it's funny because I remember reading. So when Adelaide, I was just telling Charles this the other day. When Adelaide was first born, I was reading the journal. And I was actually really put off by it, and I put it down because at some point I had read up to, I think I was four or five.
Yeah.
And my mom was writing about how she didn't like me.
And interesting.
I was like, and of course I've got a little, you know, I've got like a 4-month-old, and I'm looking at this innocent angel and I'm thinking,
yeah,
I don't need to read anymore. For the fact that a full-grown adult wouldn't like a child. But now that I have that child, there are days where I love her, but I don't necessarily like her either. And
right.
So
yeah. There's a big difference, right?
She's a little older, so I can look at it with humor for sure.
Right. Yeah. And it's like, I think as parents, like, that's kind of like that, the kind of that common humanity that we have, right? Where it's like, some days we feel like, you know, like we're masterful parents, like, oh, I've got this, right? And then other days you feel like such a horrible failure, right? Where you're just like, I hope that kind of happened before their memory like actually kicks in, because I'm like a horrible failure as a parent, right? And then on those days, the one thing that I liked about those days was when they would go down to sleep and you'd kind of like look in on them to check in on them. And they'd look so peaceful, even though they were little terrors that day, right? They just like totally peaceful, and you could kind of like breathe again knowing that tomorrow would be a fresh start. So
yes, and on those days I very specifically go and sit down with her at night and just look at her little face, and she still suckles.
She's
almost 5 and she still suckles like when she used to feed. And so when she's asleep, her little mouth suckles. And so it doesn't matter how hard of a day it is. I sit there and I just watch that and I'm grounded again. But it happens fast. And, you know, I've got to be honest, I'm scared for the whole empty nest thing. Because you have to figure yourself out all over again, don't you?
Well, 100% you do, right? Because, you know, I think I'd heard this or I'd said it or I can't remember, but it's like one of those things that you adopt where you're like, oh no, I must have come up with that, but I likely didn't. But it was like, I remember thinking like, you don't know how selfish you actually are until you get married. And then you don't realize how selfish you've been until you have a kid. Do you know what I mean? It's like there's this progression where you have to, when you get married, you have to learn to kind of give, even at times where it's like, where you're too tired, like to, you know, to be kind of who you need to be in a situation. And then when you become a parent, you also need to kind of find that extra depth to the well, right? Where it's like, oh, I didn't realize I had anything left to give, but you've got to, because that's kind of what parenting requires, right? It's like, no, I'm exhausted, but you know, my kid needs to play right now. And so playing would be good. And then there's some revitalization in that too, right? So anyways, and then empty nesting comes along and you're like, wow, you start to rediscover yourself. You're right. You said that. You start to rediscover yourself. You start to.
I see a book in it. Honestly, I see a book in that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
The emotions that you're going through right now are so fresh and so real. You they'll probably numb as years go on. I would
write
paper and a pen and start writing that now.
I think that's a great idea. That's the one thing. Like, once I started writing, like actual books, once I started writing, it was like, because there, I went through a whole period of time where I'm like, I don't know if I can do this. There's like a million people in the world that would be better than me to, you know, to do this and yada, yada, yada. And then once I was like, oh, I just have to do this. Like, I just have to. Now it's like, I just have I've got like three books lined up in my head where I'm just like, okay, that's next, that's next, then that's next. And so, yeah, so I'm just like, I'm just coming to the end of a novel. Like, I've just finished the second draft, and so I'm getting ready to send it out to some editing now. And I'm already thinking like, okay, I'm already like, am I going to start like basically the next book? Am I going to start to outline it tomorrow type thing? Like, I'm kind of like, that's how my mind works. But then I'm like, shoot, I also have to like, you know, I also have to talk about my book and promote my books too. Otherwise nobody's going to read them. And then I'm just writing them, and I'm like, hey, next book. And then maybe posthumously people will be like, hey, there was this guy who used to fly fish and never read it, but now that he's dead, I think I'll read it. So I don't want to be that. I love kind of like knowing that people have read it. Like, I had this one guy that I've started to fish with, and he has a 12 or 13 year old son, and a few months ago he's like, yeah, no, I'm reading your book to my son every night. He says I'm reading, you know, a chapter or two to him right before bed. We're reading it together. And I ended up going fishing with them just kind of a week or two ago, and they had finished it, and the son said to me, he said that was like, that's my favorite book. He said, that's the best book I've ever read. And it just was like, it just totally warmed my heart. Right. Because I'm like, oh, that's so cool. Knowing that a dad is reading a story that I've written to his son was cool enough. Right. But then for the kid to say that, I was just like, oh man, that's like, yeah. Anyways.
He's sitting back in the theater wanting more.
Right? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, 100%. Yeah, 100%. He's just like, yeah. So anyways, it's got lots of twists and turns in it. I hope that you'll, and you probably won't, because I know like, you're like, you always operate on red line. And I think that that's kind of your sweet spot, right? When you're kind of like always redlining and always like flying this way and that way. And like, kind of like, yeah, I'm getting married in 2 days, but I'll come out and film with you guys. Or yeah, I'm 5 months pregnant, but I'll come out and film with you guys, or whatever it is, right? So, but I do hope that at some point you'll get a chance to read the whole thing. And even if you don't, I would love one day for like, obviously it's every author's dream, but I would love one day if somebody was like, oh, we need to make this into a movie. And then you could watch it in like an hour and a half rather than reading the whole book. So yeah.
It's the first thing I thought when you were talking about the storyline. I was thinking this would be a good movie. And as far as reading the whole book, yeah, I absolutely will. I've got it scheduled in my calendar every night to read for an hour. So I'm getting myself back when it comes to that.
Nice.
So,
yeah. Okay.
It's an investment into my own mental health.
Nice. Okay. And then make sure you get to like, because there's a lot of, there is like, it, this stuff happens right away, but then like kind of, then there's some setup, and then kind of when you get to like chapter 8 or 9 or like right in there, it like, yeah. So make sure you stick with it. Okay. Like totally.
Yeah. 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 Have you thought about turning it into an audiobook? I love audiobooks.
I know they
go against like what you believe with the papers and with the pages.
Right. Yeah. No, I have, I've had a few people that have asked me that now. And I'm like, yeah, no, I think that that's a good idea. Cause there's so many people, right? Like, you know, we're traveling so many places. And it's just like, what a great way to, you know, to kill like a 4 hour flight or whatever, right? Just kind of put walking,
like as a mom, or, yeah, taking Adelaide out with a stroller. She's asleep a lot of the time. And I need I listen to podcasts, but I love listening to audiobooks while I'm walking.
Yeah. You know what? That's a really good idea.
April, you're a genius. You'd be doing us all a service. You'd be doing us all a favor as busy working parents.
Okay, I will. I'll put that in the bug of the magazine people. I know people. The powers that be. I know people, so we can make stuff like this happen. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
Well, look. So people can find it on the website flyfusion.com or rb.ca. We.com.
Yeah, it's flyfusionmag.com. Yeah.
Thank you.
Or or again on if they want to go to Amazon, they can get it there too. Yeah. Or if you want to show up at my door, I've got copies for sale too, but I'm not going to give my address, so you'd have to play kind of a Where's Waldo. But if you did, and you were like, "Hey, I'm here. I want to buy a copy of your book." I'd be like, "Oh, okay."
Just anyways, show up
no,
at Derek's
don't.
Door
please
and
don't.
Say,
yeah, please don't.
Hey,
how did you do it to Jack?
Hey.
Hey. Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yeah. That's like the second time in my life where I've done something like that, where I've got like this big speech planned, and then I show up, and I'm just like totally overcome by the moment. Hey. Yeah, just a hey. The other time was when I was asking my father-in-law, before he was my father-in-law, if I could have his daughter's hand in marriage.
You said hey? No.
No, it wasn't. It was almost as bad though, because I had this whole speech planned, right? And I'd like sat down across the table from him. We were out at a restaurant, and it was like. I had it all planned. It was just great in my mind. And it came out like, so it's just wondering if, and it came out like that. And I was just like, oh man, how could that happen? Right? Like, yeah. Anyways, I guess I get nervous at times and things don't come out properly, you know, during big life events, right? Where it's like, this could change the course of your life. Yeah. So,
we'll wrap it up and I'll let you get back to your night there. Before we wrap it up, is there anything that you would like to add or to ask me? Do not turn this into a second interview, Derek. I know you. It was meant to be a quick courtesy question.
I like that. You know what? I do want to add one thing. I won't ask. I won't turn this into a second interview. And yes, you do know that I'll just keep talking. But I do want to say that I really like I wholeheartedly appreciate what you're doing, and I've loved to see kind of your trajectory over the last number of years. I think that that what you do and what I hear time and time and time again is just that, like, how much of an inspiration you are to everybody, but specifically, you know, to like a lot of the young ladies that, you know, have kind of gotten into fly fishing, or that, you know, kind of needed that, like needed a role model or needed somebody to look at and go, hey, she does that, I can do that too. And I know it's not just kind of, it's not just young ladies that do that, but I've heard from a number of them that do that. And so good for you. Keep doing what you're doing. Keep kind of building what you're building. It's awesome. It's incredible. And I think that, you know, again, yeah, it goes back to kind of like, yeah, we share a lot in common, right? Like, I'm talking about people, humans, individual, we share so much in common, right? And kind of public or mass communication reveals that. And we have a huge responsibility as people who kind of like share a message or send a message out. So keep doing what you're doing, April. And yeah, and way to go. So
awesome. Well, thank you so much. And likewise to you. And don't be a stranger. And keep me posted on the next book, please.
Awesome. I will do that. All right.
Okay.
Thanks for having me. All right. Take care.
And that concludes this episode of Anchored. Thank you for listening.
In Wild Country, rules were not created by man. Don't miss Wild Country, Wednesdays from 7 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Presented by Primos. Speak the language. Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment. Don't miss Mondays with Into the Blue, brought to you by Academy Sports and Outdoors. Every Monday night from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment.